The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
My name is Michael Guyot, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour is Eric Balchunas. I'm sure many of you have seen Eric on Bloomberg. He's a senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg. Going to be talking about the insanity that's happened this year, getting into some of the weeds as far as fund flows and this idea that this seems to be the year for alternatives, but maybe with some caveats to that. So, Eric, for those who aren't familiar with your background, talk about how you got involved in markets, what led you to Bloomberg, and what's the kind of primary focus for you?
Yeah, so my primary focus is ETFs. I got into this, you know, just by liking my economics class in college, to be honest. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. But anyway, I like markets. I like economics. I like all the places it sends your brain. And then I also like journalism. I wrote for the college paper, and so I combined those two and been doing it ever since. I'm an institutional investor. I did PR for a while, which people underestimate. You have to get ideas and write a press release. I think it's an underrated profession. And then I worked in data for 15 years, just looking for something different. And Bloomberg's data office is, you know, anybody who knows the terminal, the data office is like the Keebler Elves or the warehouse where they make the automobiles for Tesla. It is the warehouse that makes the terminal. It's how the terminal happens. And I spent 15 years there. So then now I'm in research where I combined all that data that I had access to and helped build out with writing, which is a pretty ideal place for me, I think. And so I lead a small team of about six people who cover ETFs worldwide for Bloomberg's research arm, which is called Bloomberg Intelligence. And so all we do is write notes about what's going on in ETFs, passive. We dabble in mutual funds a little bit and some other structures, but I'd say it's 80, 90%. ETFs. And that's pretty much it. I mean, that's just in a nutshell.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into it on the ETF side, because taking out the commodity and energy space, everything has gotten smoked this year. And you often see people referencing fund flows. Talk about what you've seen in terms of the progression of fund movement this year, again, outside of energy and commodities. What's been happening in the ETF landscape? Where has money been going to and getting out of?
Yeah. Let me start real high level. We'll call this the 10,000 foot view and just say there's been about $250 billion out of mutual funds, and there's been $250 billion into ETFs. Not that the money coming out of the mutual funds necessarily went into the ETFs, but I want to say that retail as a whole organism is pretty much flat. I think that's a demographic situation. I think the boomers are getting out of Dodge now. They're like, you know what? I had a good run, especially in bond funds. And the Fed seems to be antagonistic towards my goals now. Let me just not wait to see if these guys can turn it around. I'm out. ETF investors tend to be younger and more trading oriented. And so within that $250 billion, it's pretty spread around. For a while, it was equities, and then fixed income caught up last month. But people are choosing their battles. I can see there's some frustrating things like, in the sector world, nobody can really find anything that works besides energy. In the bond world, it was all about cash, bonds, and treasuries for a while because mostly people were that scared and nervous, didn't know what to do. Now I see money going into junk bonds a little bit. It's getting a little more, interested in risk. The muni bond ETF has taken in a lot. So, people are looking. I almost equate it to the flows to me seem like there's two things going on. One is the sort of buy and hold Vanguardian investor that just plows in money no matter what. The top three ETFs for the year are VOO, IVV, both S&P 500, and VTV, which is the Vanguard Value. VTI is fourth. So you get an idea of this. The boring stuff is still taking in most of the money. But elsewhere, people are looking for places to go. And like I said, some places that people have found that are eking out a positive gain are gold, high dividend strategies like HDV and USF, or not, so floating rate notes. And then there's one from Pacer called CALS, which is companies that are largely have a lot of free cash flow. That's up 7% this year, which isn't a lot, but compared to the market, it's killing it. So money is sort of finding these little spots. But as you said, most things have been smoked. But people have tried. Like they've been, you know, look at ARK. People have been buying that even though it's going down. There's other examples of people buying stuff even though it's going. Healthcare ETF, XLV. People put in $6 billion to that, and it's down 8%, although I guess that's decent performance relative. But anyway, that's a general look at what's happening this year. And I don't know, if there's any one of those areas you want to explore, let me know. But I'd say that's generally the gist of it.
Yeah, so the demographic aspect is interesting. Maybe let's tease that out a little bit, because, yes, I'm going to assume that the data would show that more retirees have mutual funds than ETFs. And obviously, because of their age, they tend to have more income-producing types of asset classes, funds, than not. But I would think that those retirees may not have necessarily bombed out of their bond mutual fund allocations, right? Because we know from behavioral finance, there's something called mental accounting. Most individuals will separate out the income that they get, the check that they get from their bond position, from the value of the underlying bond itself, right? And you saw a lot of that in 08. A lot of bond funds were going down in value heavy, but as long as people were getting their monthly check from that coupon, that dividend, you know, they were fine with it. Talk about some of the differences in terms of fund flow, specifically for bonds with mutual funds that you've seen and with ETFs, because this has been really the real pain point this year.
Absolutely. Bond mutual funds, and especially bond managers, have really had a charmed existence. They have not been hit with the same outflows that have hit their stock picking brothers and sisters. And so in this nice low rate environment over the past 15 years, bond mutual funds and active bond mutual funds in particular have completely bucked the trend. But every time the rates go up or Powell would say something hawkish, instantly, as soon as the bond mutual fund goes negative, even for a month, like it's down 2% or something, people start bailing. It's very price sensitive. Once those things go red, the investors start getting out of Dodge. And in March 2020, we saw $190 billion go out in like 2 weeks. And that's when the Fed stepped in. And after the Fed stepped in, it's been back to flow-a-thon for bond funds. But now this year, basically $223 billion has gone out. I will say it's going out in a nice, even pattern, about $20 billion every week. But that's a lot of selling pressure. It's almost like reminds me of one of those things, you know, when you put that thing on at the dentist that just sort of suppresses your body before an x-ray. I feel like that those outflows are that to the bond market. There's just this constant selling pressure. And those outflows are way more than the ETF fixed income inflows. So retail is net sellers of bonds. And I don't know how this ends, because the bond mutual funds have $5 trillion. Fixed income ETFs have a trillion. So they're five times bigger. The boomers are way older. They're 70. And I unless the bond managers can figure a way out, I don't know if anybody hangs in there. And the problem, obviously, is that if you're a big fund and the Fed raises interest rates, all the bonds you currently hold just aren't as appealing. And so the price goes down. And so, for example, this year, the biggest bond fund on earth is the PIMCO Income Fund, and that is down 6.7%. Now, to the PM and PIMCO's credit, that's better than the AG, which is down 9%. People don't care. It's just red. So I think the bond funds are going to have to figure out a way somehow to get back into the green. And I'm not sure how they do it with a Fed that's so antagonistic towards what they're trying to do. And I really think the Fed is completely gone from the situation, because inflation is the number one issue in the coming midterm elections. And we know that that's going to be on the Fed's mind. And so I don't see them backing off of this. So I've written about this, and that I think if there's one challenge to the Fed's goal, it's if there's some kind of a crisis in the bond mutual fund market, because these are regular people's retirements. let's say a big popular fund has to halt redemptions or something, that could cause a run on these funds. Now, I will say the flows are orderly, but we're watching it because, as you know, this thing can turn into a downward spiral quickly. So, you know, we'll see. But right now, some of these funds are down 6, 8, 9%. And the PIMCO Income Fund in particular, which is the biggest, has seen $13 billion in outflows. And its assets are down $22 billion. That's a 15%. It's 15% smaller. And we're only halfway through the year. So this is a pretty big deal, in my opinion, given how much money these funds have and how much they are really America's retirement system.
Okay, but there are nuances to that discussion, right? And that really relates to credit quality, right? So I haven't seen anybody talk about this before, but this has been a really strange year in that you've had a bond market sell-off without a real blowout in credit spreads where, you know, corporate credit, in particular junk debt, really, you know, takes it on the chin. If you were to look at the AGG, aggregate bond AAA ETF, which, you know, is considered a conservative type of allocation, ex-dividend, what's remarkable to me is that it's below the COVID crash, meaning, it, you know, because of the yield spike and everything that's gone on there, it's, you know, way below the COVID crash levels ex-dividend. You look at the junk debt ETF, HYG or JNK, ex-dividend, those are way above their COVID crash levels, which means that, to your point, it's been orderly, but it has not been centered around a repricing of default risk. Now, talk about flows in terms of those that look at bonds as a way of playing equities, which is really junk debt. How does the junk debt space look in terms, you alluded to this idea that there's some flows going in there, but how has the junk debt side in particular looked? Because I think that's where it could really get messy because there's a lot less liquidity there versus, you know, AAA.
Yeah, you're right. The junk bond ETFs have been horrible. $11 billion in outflows, and that's including some inflows over the past month. So it's really been like $13 billion has come out this year. But this past month, people have come back about $3 billion in. So potentially there's some models out there that are looking at these things as maybe oversold. Maybe they see that this idea that the economy's maybe in trouble and the Fed will back off. You know, I think junk bond debts are probably a way to bet that a little bit. But you're right. I mean, if I look at HYG, it's down 8%. But I will say the ag is down worse, and which is, I think, the interest rate issue there is the TLT is down 22%. So
right, it's the treasury duration play, right?
Absolutely. The duration is the bigger deal this year. But to your point, if all this is happening without a credit issue, I think that's I'm not a big bearish guy, but I will say there's just been this 15-year perfect environment for bond funds. And now we have one problem, but there could be multiple, to your point. But I will say the ETF side, they see opportunity in junk debt right now. And that's, I guess that's a good sign. But again, if these big mutual funds are constantly seeing outflows, that forces them to sell. And that constant selling pressure, I just wonder how much a rally can actually happen with that headwind. But I mean, the market's bigger than just mutual funds and ETFs, but they're symbolic, I think.
So, and the market within the bond space, its biggest is treasuries. So let's hit a little bit on treasuries because that's been the real pain point for anybody that's tried to either play defensive, play risk off, or uses that as part of a more diversified portfolio. Risk parity strategies have arguably gotten hit the most because treasuries have not acted as they historically do as a risk-off safe haven play. When risk-off treasuries are acting like risk-on, there's nothing you can really do except wait it out and take the pain, right? Yes. How in the people that you talk to who have studied some of these relationships, what do you attribute this kind of correlation drawdown to in terms of equities and treasuries? Because I don't buy it's the inflation story or the Fed story, because the speed with which long duration yields have spiked is way more than spreads have widened, way more than the Fed has hiked rates. There's something else going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be open to suggestions, but I try to keep it real simple. The 60 and the 40 went up together for a long time, and I think the Fed induced and helped it along. I'm not saying it's the only reason it went up, but low rates help both bonds and stocks, right? And a Fed, you know, an accommodative Fed helps both too. So it would only stand to reason if the Fed completely reverses course that both would go down for a little while. And I'm a big fan of TLT. I've looked at its awesome ability to really hedge a portfolio. GLD is not a hedge. TLT is a hedge traditionally. It completely offset your losses in 2008. And every other time since, it's done pretty well. I call it a nice organic hedge too. Most other hedges involve derivatives, options, and a lot of like corrosion and costs. The TLT is organic, but this year, obviously, it's not working. And I do think there's been some flows into it. I do think people still like it as a crisis hedge. Like, let's say the war in Ukraine got really bad and potentially drew in other countries. I could see TLT completely shaking off the whole Fed thing and going up because of this sort of rush to for safety because of its crisis hedge. But I think the Fed is their bigger force in TLT and its inability to go up this year and go down a lot, frankly. But again, I can't say I'm a macro strategist. That's just my read on it. So even as a personal investor, though, I kind of look at this year as like we were due. You know, this is the piper has come. We got a lot of free stuff over the years, a lot of candy, and now we got to just take the pain a little bit. And this is the price of admission to getting those nice returns from both those asset classes. And I do think over time, once the market shakes off the sort of addiction it had to the Fed, I think it'll start operating normally again. I just think this is one of those like years where it has to sort of unwind the Fed put and that idea that the Fed would be there. That's my opinion. You're right. There could be something else, but I can't say I track this as closely as maybe some other people like yourself.
Yeah, no, and I'll add a couple of thoughts to that. I mean, you said it spot on, and that's what's consistent in all the research studies I'm known for, and it's the premise behind the opportunity set of all. It's exactly to your point. It tends to be a hedge on average. It's, to your point, the crisis play. In a real risk-off period, you get convexity, treasuries rally, and it's not unusual to see in a real crisis the S&P go down heavy while TLT rallies, and you can get like a 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 basis point relative spread very quickly in weeks. I mean, you saw that with the COVID crash because it did what it was supposed to do, going risk off, and that behavior persisted. If there's any positive to this enormous pain in the correlation of treasuries to equities in high volatility, is that now at least you've got some room to make money going risk off whenever that behavior returns, right? Because yields are higher, which means you can maybe get one of those junctures where yields really drop meaningfully again as stocks go through another wave lower. And we'll touch on that because that kind of dovetails a little bit into housing and what some of the fund flows I want to hear your thoughts on as relates to the mortgage space and mortgage ETFs. Yeah, no. I think that's an important color. And I keep using this line. I keep going back to it. I feel like I'm repetitive with this, but you know, when you look at investor psychology, they wanted yield when there was none. Now they don't want yield when there is some, right? And that's another point too, Eric, and I want you to kind of riff on this. You said, you know, the bond market has to kind of resolve this somehow. You don't know how, but while it's been painful, arguably, the more yields go up quicker, the actual better it is, because in order for these bond ETFs and bond mutual funds to maintain their duration, they have to keep on buying bonds, right? Because otherwise they mature and there's an end date. So the higher yields go, at some point those coupons will reflect, it actually helps from a total return perspective.
Correct. Yeah, at some point. I think the question is, you know, when. This also kind of brings into play, like, I think a lot of people bought bond funds back in the day because of the return. You know, that's the PIMCO, I think, deserves credit or blame. I don't know what you call for really looking at the bond market as something where you can kill it. And so, yeah, I think that when the returns there go negative, people are like, oh, this isn't working anymore. Whereas I think traditionally people looked at bonds as like the sort of secure, safe place that's just not going to do a lot. But that changed, obviously, over the last 20, 30 years. So, you know, I agree with you. At some point, they'll be buying the bonds with the higher yields, and that will be reflected. And the yields will get attractive enough, as you say, people like yield, that they'll buy them, and the price will go up. So I guess, you know, it's just a matter of when. So I guess that's the good news.
Talk about, Eric, some of the defensive sector fund flows for a bit. So you mentioned energy, but that's not really defensive, right? Utilities have been unrelenting in terms of outperformance. You mentioned healthcare, consumer staples, also kind of the trifecta dividend plays have been where there's been really strong relative outperformance. What's that space been looking like? Because I have to tell you, that's also one of the frustrations for me. Usually when defensive sectors like that are leading, you see long duration yields falling, meaning you see TLT do well, right? This, you've had a complete divergence, you know, this year in terms of the message of the defensive sectors and the message of the defensive asset class.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Yeah, if we look at the first quarter, the believe it or not, tech was still in taking in the most flows amongst those sectors. Energy was 2, healthcare was 3, staples was there. So I would say it's largely defensive. Tech's just the beast. But I think people were also still just like in disbelief that that trade could ever end. But anyway, now in the second quarter, things got way nasty. Basically, a lot of the stuff that people bought in the first quarter, including financials, massive outflows. And so basically most of the sectors have seen outflows, some love for consumer staples and utilities. So it got much more defensive in the second quarter. And this is a trend through all of the ETF flows. I felt there was a sort of, I hate to use the word capitulation, it's so overused, but there was a bit of a capitulation, or maybe the trader crowd got tired of trying different doors out of this dark room, and has sort of, the sector world overall has seen net outflows. That is very rare. Sectors are always net positive. In when you unpack them, there usually is some positive, some negative, but they always net positive, but now they're net negative. So that tells you that, you know, there's not a lot working. And I don't know, you know, energy is up so much, but that's the one thing that obviously has worked. But I can tell from the flows here, it did well in the first quarter. People are starting to take profits in it now. And there was a big trade that I think is noteworthy for anyone. It's the COMT is a commodity ETF from BlackRock. And like, you know, it's not huge, but they use it in their own models. And they recently rotated out of it. It looked like a classic profit-taking trade. And I looked at that as possibly a good sign for equities. But, and I think they went into IVV, I'm not sure. But also a sign that commodities might, that trade might be, you know, a little long in the tooth and the profit taking could bring it down. So usually a model portfolio tends to be, you see a big giant flow in an ETF like that, that's usually professional. It's usually based on a signal. And that was interesting to us. We have not seen it totally play out, but I'm looking here at energy ETFs and they are starting to see outflows a little bit. So that's something that is new as well.
Let's pivot a little bit to emerging markets for a bit beyond China, which we'll talk about China as well. But, you know, historically it was kind of taken for granted that as commodities go, so too will the emerging markets, right? Brazil clearly has been a beneficiary of the commodity run. How has investor interest been in on the emerging market side? So you don't have the Russia component of BRICS anymore, and China, you know, is full of unknowns. Where else has money been flowing to there?
In EM, if I'm just going to quickly look at year-to-date flows, besides VWO, I'll just call that the boring blob money. EMV is probably the biggest success story. EEMV, if as you know, is emerging markets low vol, so or min vol. That's only down 8%, whereas EEM is down 12%. So clearly there's some relative performance chasing there. And EELV, which is emerging markets low vol, which also is interesting. Minimum vol tries to keep sector allocation similar to EEM. That's not doing as well as EELV, which is, let's just go after the lowest vol stocks. That's actually up. So anyway, point being, min vol, low vol is where some people are going. And then also EMXC, which is emerging markets ex China, has taken in about $1 billion, which is a lot for it. And that's a bit related to that trade that that is similar to Freedom, which is one of Perth Toll, who's a lot of people know her at this point.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Right. You're Xing out Russia and China. This just Xs out China, but it's punching way above its weight. Why? Because it's down a little less, although it's still down 11.7%. It's not done that great. So EM's pretty much like getting clobbered. There's not really a lot of places to hide. Jeremy's on the phone. I'll give him a shout out because DEM, which is emerging market dividends, that's only down 3%. And so I think if you go dividends or low vol, that sort of seems to be where there's a little bit of breathing room. Those areas have they're not up though. They've just, you know, gone down less, I guess. So it's a bloodbath, but the flows are still 16 billion in. And I think people have, that's maybe part of a reallocation, like a rebalance, because EM has been so bad that people have rebalanced into it, but all those flows haven't really helped it that much.
So Eric, I want to go to the name of the space here, how 2022 became the year for alts. And I have a very complicated question for you, which is, how the hell do you define what an alternative is?
Yeah, good question. Like, do you consider gold an alt? Right. I kind of do. But when we classify ETFs, we're sort of looking at ETFs that are doing hedge fund strategies. And, you know, a lot of them will have a short position as part of their strategy. And these strategies have really had a tough time in the past 15 years because the 60 and the 40, as I said earlier, has done so well. Well, now that that's struggling, alts are getting some looks, although it's not that great. I think they probably need a whole year of good returns. But there's a couple in here that have taken in some decent money. Actually, we have this guy coming on ETF IQ tomorrow, Andrew Beer, which is DBMF. It's a managed futures fund.
Andrew,
it's
well, definitely.
Yeah, you know him. So it's up 25%. If you can lay that down, you're going to see some flows. I mean, you can't have, you know, that's a shiny object moment, if I've ever seen one, especially this year. But then there's like some other ones, like, you know, one of the most popular alt ETFs is QAI, which is the IQ Hedge Multi-Strategy ETF, which synthetically replicates a hedge fund multi-strategy index. And QAI and this other one called M&A, which replicates merger arb, they're both down, but although they're better than the market. But I think what we're going to find here is that the true alts are going to probably do better. QAI and M&A are alts built for advisors. They have a partial hedge. And a lot of these ETFs, especially from, they don't go all the way. Whereas some of them that do go all the way are seeing better returns. I would put BTAL in there. That goes long, low vol stocks and short, high beta stocks. That's up 13%. So, I mean, there are some good spots in here where you would completely have offset your market losses here. The question is, did you choose right? And, you know, that's what we try to help people. And when we cover the alts, what we've done over the years is we don't really show you, we show you the correlation and we show you the volatility. And I think those are two important aspects for what an alt should be, because obviously if it's a true long short, the vol is real low and the correlation is real low. And so, but you know how advisors work. They actually tend to go with the ones that have a little more beta in there. And this goes across for factor of world too. A lot of the hardcore factors don't see the same kind of love as the watered down ones because you know, the advisor world is afraid of tracking error. But I would argue you want a lot of tracking error in the alt space, because if you had picked low correlation, low vol, and high tracking, you would have had a great hedge. The flows aren't that great considering some of these performance numbers they've laid down. You know, 100 million, 50 million. I mean, I guess relative to the size of the alt space, there's only $5 billion in assets. That's like 0.1% of ETF assets. It's pretty good. But yeah, this is a space that just can't seem to take off. And I don't know. Jeremy may have a theory on this. They've attempted a lot in the alt space. My theory is that alts, I think, are just something that the institutional world is sometimes just much more knowledgeable of and understands better. And the advisor world and the retail world, until they're maybe more forced to learn about them, I don't know if they might just be find them too complicated. But Jeremy may have another theory on why they haven't taken off yet. Yeah, by the way, the oil ETF is just a sad story. USO is the ticker, and it's up like it's had such a great run, but nobody cares. You know why? Because back in 2020, during Oilmageddon, the futures actually, I believe they went negative for a minute, and the ETF got scared that it would actually have to owe investors money. So it went from the front and second month, and it diversified across the curve. Once you do that as an ETF, once you, I call it self-neutering, once you self-neuter, you just lose all your fans, because those people want the juice. This isn't something, you know, it's almost like making it more low vol and, digestible, not digestible, but tolerable, I guess. And USO lost all its customers. And so even though it's outperforming, it's seen nothing but outflows. It lost its local base. Maybe it can bring it back if it were to go back to the front or second month. We saw this happen with the VIX ETFs, even though
the short volatility after revolving, same thing happened, right?
Yeah, honestly, people love them. And they were sad they went away. They were sad they neutered. I think all the users of those funds were probably like, yeah, okay, fine. Maybe except maybe like a target manager or two who was like an idiot and bought it and never like took profits or whatever. But people really miss those funds. And that's why there's two new ones that have come out from volatility shares that are just like TVIX and XIV, and they're immediate hits. They've already about trading 100 million a day, which is unheard of for a new launch. And they've built up a steady volume. And I'm not surprised. When it comes to the trading tools, give the people the juice and leave them alone. Don't try to be their parent. And USO, I feel for them, though, that they were looking at possibly owing investors money. And so they had to do something.
Yeah, I mean, there's liability risk too, Eric, right? I mean, you know, at some point, you have to be careful as a business risk, as an issue.
Can I chime in there real quick? Because this is a really fascinating topic for me. And we have this ongoing theme we write about where ETFs can't go. I mean, they cannot serve you up farmland. They can't serve physical
By the way, I just spaced at noon talking about exactly that point, talking about farmland as an investment. But anyway.
I think this is – every now and then something gets popular. Farmland, you know, forests in Brazil, or in private equity. You can't ETFize certain things. That said, to your point about the liquidity, the Cliff Asness had a great quote on a recent Morningstar interview we called the volatility laundering. And it's interesting, private equity, I mean, it's hard not to be, I sort of feel for the people who show their holdings and their prices, especially their daily pricing. You have to live in that volatility sort of roller coaster. And it's all out there. And obviously, people's stomachs aren't as strong as when you only have to show them once or whenever you want, and you can market how you want. It's a little unfair, in my opinion, but I can see your point of view. If you're an advisor or an institution, that would seem so appealing to me but is it real? And I would ask Jeremy, you know, he's built some legit alts, like a managed futures fund. Jeremy, would you say this is any different than how an actual hedge fund does it?
Right, but it's also part of the joke of the pinned tweet. There's also the impression, though, that alternatives are an alternative to making money, right? Because they haven't really made much money. And to Eric's point, it's been a beta-driven world. I would argue, really, a lot of things broke down for alternatives really when QE3 started. I mean, QE3 in all my work is where a lot of these kind of dynamics, alpha, went down to zero. A lot of things started happening. There's a breakdown of inflation expectations and equity movement. And it becomes hard, I think, Eric, to your point, you've got to have more than what we've seen for people to really get excited about true diversification. There's still a strong buy-the-dip mentality, buy-the-beta mentality. And performance chasing, you know, needs some stickiness for it to last for a multi-year cycle.
No, I agree. It might take a whole year for the alt space to lay down some of these returns and people to notice. I do think there's, again, as the gentleman said earlier, Ken is his name, that actually, if you have exposure to actual hedge funds, you know, they'll probably benefit as well. So it's not like the alts obviously have competition. And I do think they can be complicated. You know, I remember writing about the Index IQ merger arb ETF. I called it I wrote this whole article, Poor Man's Hedge Fund, right? And, you know, I was called out on Twitter, which is one of the good parts of Twitter, although it's not pleasant, by somebody who knew the fund better or smarter or saw something I did. And this was early in my days as an analyst. I've really tried to not make this mistake again. But he was the one who told me, look, this is only partially hedged. This is not really a hedge fund. And it's tempting sometimes to say, oh, well, you can buy this hedge fund strategy for this fee. It trades every day. But not all these ETFs are exactly like a hedge fund. And further, they're all very nuanced. You know, let's say energy ETFs. You go into the sector. Okay, there's Vanguard, iShares, and Spider. They're all sort of the same. You know, there's some stocks they have, some they don't. But they're largely going to get beta energy, right? Here, they're all over the map in terms of how they decide to do their strategies. And you kind of have to read a lot of the fine print. And generally, that's been tough to sell that in ETFs.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. I'm curious, Eric, because again, a lot of people, especially on FinTwit, will reference fund flows and use it as some kind of data point to validate their view of which direction markets end up going. Have you done any or seen any studies that show there's merit to the idea that fund flows are a signal, or is that just one of those things where people say it but it doesn't really bear out in reality?
Man, that's a good question. I'm torn on. I'm agnostic. Sometimes it is. You know, Jeremy's on the call right now, and honestly, that first little flowathon into DXJ back in the day was clearly a signal that this was a massive feeding frenzy for currency hedge ETFs that lasted about 7 years.
That's when Corona came in, right? That was the catalyst.
Yeah, that was when Abe was elected in Japan, and we had all these governments trying to devalue their own currencies.
Right.
So it obviously was a perfect environment for those ETFs. And then, like, you know, you have so I think in this specific area, that's why I point out COMT. Sometimes you can see early flows. It's like a swell before a wave. And a lot of times those are spot on. ETFs are used by some very smart people. And if you get like retail and the trading crowd kind of coming together, and you can spot it early enough, it usually is a sign of what's to come. And they also tell you, like, hey, people like cheap. Like right now, we have a whole theme, which is cheap or shiny, because the flows tend to go to either really dirt cheap stuff or really wild and crazy different stuff, arguably to complement the boring cheap stuff. But those are, I think, ways you can interpret them. Now, I've just never, ever said that, oh, I'm looking at these flows and it's going to help me determine what will go up or down. I'm a firm believer that there's too much noise and false positives, and the market just kind of does what it wants sometimes. So I guess that'd be my answer. They're useful and they're interesting, but I don't know if I'd build a whole trading strategy around it.
Okay. So I'm glad you mentioned this kind of shiny versus cheap aspect to ETFs, because for those that don't know, maybe explain what you mean by shiny object moment for the audience first.
Yeah. So there's beta ETFs like Vanguard, BlackRock, right? You know, Vanilla. And you can get all that stuff now for 3 to 5 basis points. Even a value ETF is now like 4 basis points. So 95% of the portfolio has been commoditized by the Vanguard effect. And that would be cheap. Now, on the flip side, there's shiny objects. Now, it used to be if an active manager could outperform the S&P by 2 percentage points, or eke out some excess return, that was really good. I don't know if people care that much about that because they've got the sort of fundamental stuff covered in the cheap. So what they want is they want like lottery tickets to put on top of that boring core. And so that's why you've had the rise of funds like ARK, the thematic ETFs. I would even put crypto in there, NFTs. I think they perfectly, in a ironic way, the rise of passive has really helped those areas that are pretty crazy. And so what happens is if one of these ETFs has what's called a shiny object moment, where it's not beating the S&P by 2%, it's beating it by, like, I don't know, at least 20, if not 100%. It's like lapping it. People look and go, ooh, what's that? Like, you know, humans do. And then you need something else for the flows to happen. They need to see that and they need to go, like for Kathy, let's say, oh, wow, what's that thing outperforming? Then they go, oh, well, of course innovation would do well. The narrative has to kick in too, because we have seen some shiny object moments where the flows don't follow. And one of those good examples was video games early on. Those ETFs had they were up 100% and like nobody cared. And I really was starting to try to figure out why. And that's led us to his theory that advisors were like, I'm not buying video games. This is before people really understood the power of that market. They were just like, oh, it's like Atari and Donkey Kong. It's a horrible industry that's like corrupting the youth. And they did not buy it. And so I think the narrative also has to register. So you need the shiny object moment and then the narrative. Once those two things come together, the flows will follow. And that lane is about 20% of flows. And so that's why I think you're going to continue to see, and we show it, the number of holdings in a new ETF on average has gone down steadily for 7 years. So it's almost been cut in half. So ETFs are being designed for max pop potential because they know that's how they're going to get attention. And they know investors are looking for something with possible asymmetric return. Now, that has nothing to do with actual alpha. So we actually came out with a piece that said active share is the new alpha, which is totally wrong, but just the flows show that. It seems as though alpha is becoming less important. It's just how different are you from the index, and can you go up like threefold over the benchmark, not can you deliver a little alpha? And I don't know, the flows show this. People may disagree, but it just seems like a new world right now.
So I think that's utterly fascinating in terms of the number of positions on average, right? Because products are being designed for concentration risk to have that shiny object moment, and then performance follows. You get the assets, and hopefully it sticks around long enough to get some fees on it. And I hate to say it, but that's kind of the reality. Now, there's this other dynamic, Eric, which is interesting around the availability of products that have the potential for that kind of shiny object moment, which is that oftentimes I think it comes more from the smaller issuers that are more entrepreneurial and trying to stand out in a different way, which means that they have to charge higher fees to just to survive. I've got to charge a percent or more. And people look at that and say, well, you know, that's way too high a fee. My response is, well, I can't survive if the fee isn't high enough to get that kind of differentiated return, which nobody else is out there presenting. So how do you think about how fees play into the pipeline of product launches? Because the reality is it's really hard to create a strategy which is different and also have a revenue stream, a fee attached to that, to give it time to actually work.
Yeah, well, the fees in the shiny object lane are good. They're higher. And this is another motivation for asset managers to increase the concentration of the portfolio, because if you outperform the S&P by, I don't know, let's say, we'll say 100%, you double it, people are not going to really care that it's 50 basis points more than, you know, a cheap beta ETF. Like the fee, you get away with a lot higher fees out there. And this is, you know, again, part of the, I think the appeal. Again, though, active share does not equal alpha at all. And that's what just makes this interesting, because that's ultimately been the holy grail. I think institutions still are looking for alpha, but it seems like in the advisor and retail space, they just want something that can really kill it. And I would also put leverage ETFs in here. Like leverage ETFs can really return, you know, in a week or a day, what most people would, you know, patiently wait for in a couple of years. And so there's a certain culture that is into gambling. And I think they're feeding on that to a degree. I also think if you're a small issuer, this is your only hope. And what's a small issuer going to do? Like come out with like a S&P 500 ETF or a watered down value play that's conservative. It's just, we call this the middle, you know, in between cheap and shiny is the middle. And that's where a lot of legacy active mutual funds live. And I think it, you know, they have slowly corroded over the years. The market returns have kept their assets nice and juicy, but that's gone for a while, you know, for at least the foreseeable future. And all this left is flows. And so that area is going to hollow out slowly. And again, I do believe you're going to see a barbelling of stuff that is going to have to go cheap. The big guys are all the big guys, not just Vanguard and BlackRock, but JP Morgan, Goldman, Schwab, Fidelity, they're all going to have a lineup of cheap beta, and they have to. And then you're going to have the smaller guys coming out with all this unique stuff, alts, thematic ETFs, crypto strategies. And this reminds me of the airline industry, right? You've got three major carriers that have 75% of the market, and they compete on price and, you know, different and the general routes. But then there's 20% like Hawaiian Air that just specialize in certain areas. And I think that's probably where it's going. But that 20% is going to continue to thrive, in my opinion. But the expensive, and if you're expensive and you're not doing a lot different than the index, I think you're in trouble.
No, and that's an important point, right? Because I think a lot of the cynicism around, for example, ESG funds is that a lot of these ESG funds are basically just FANG, right? They're just, it's a different name for essentially the same kind of tracking. It's not pure to what ESG would be. It's pure to momentum, right? Because that's how you get assets.
Yeah, let me chime in here because I feel we were early in being bearish on ESG. Now it's kind of trendy, but we were early, and I think sometimes we even look like the bad guys. But I was like, the main reason we were bearish on ESG was A, how hard it is to line up somebody's values with an index maker. I mean, what MSCI thinks is ESG is going to be different than like what every person's value system is. They're going to be like, well, why is Pepsi in here? I hate sugary drinks. It's just very difficult to make something subjective, objective. What's one? Number two is ESG is trying to dislodge Vanguard. Good luck with that, because what is the point of buying an ESG fund if you're not going to put it in your core and live that way? Because you're going to buy, like, put 2% of ESGU on top of your IVV, which is like the S&P 500. That makes no sense.
Right. It's like beyond an investment style. It's like a lifestyle, right?
Yeah. So anything trying to dislodge a 3 to 4 basis point beta index fund, we're bearish on. And we've been right. ESG, direct indexing, it's all been way overhyped. They'll have their little niches here and there, but what we're all bullish on is thematic ESG. We think things like the solar energy ETF or a clean energy ETF, something where it's just very easy to add on to your current portfolio and it's very clean. Your values don't matter here. You're just literally buying 30 solar stocks. There's nothing to have to unpack there. And with ESG, it's so convoluted and confusing. It's like operating in like 4 or 5 dimensions. And you don't know where you are sometimes because of the values part of that trade. And also, if you put ESG in your core this year, everybody now knows that it can underperform because the media loves ESG and they sell it as like, you know, a way to save the world and outperform. And we all know that's just not true. You might outperform sometimes, but you will underperform sometimes. So our message to ESG is be very careful. If you live your life like an ESG person, and you know who you are if you are, if you're like a hippie, you should go this way. This is going to be consistent with your lifestyle. If you're a Taurus and you just read some article in the New York Times, do not do this. You just keep your cheap beta. But for the most part, most people are. I think people love that 4 or 5 basis point beta. They think it's the best deal in town. And I just don't see them selling that out for a fund, like for something that might not include the next big juggernaut stock, like an Amazon or a Tesla. They want to participate in those returns and they want to do it at a low fee. So I think ESG at best gets 4 or 5% market share of the ETF world.
Yeah, very, very interesting perspective. Everybody that's here, please make sure you follow Eric Balchunas. And Eric, what's the podcast that you have?
My podcast is called Trillions, which you can find on iTunes or, you know, wherever they, you know, have podcasts. And it's free. So, yeah, I always say if you want my research, you got to buy a terminal, and that's not free. That's far from free. But if you want me for free, Twitter or Trillions is probably the best two ways to get our research in a free format.
And Jeremy, you have a podcast as well, right? I believe he does have a podcast. I think he might be just on.
Yeah, I know. I was on it once. It's called, I think, Behind the Markets, and it does it at Wharton.
Yeah, no, and he's got a fantastic following as well. So again, everybody, please make sure you follow Eric Balchunas. Make sure you follow Jeremy Schwartz. I'll have another space tomorrow, and I'm going to be presenting in Buffalo, which is where I am right now, to the CFA chapter on, you guessed it, Lumber to Gold. So you'll be able to hear that live as I'm talking to some fellow CFA charter holders. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Jeremy. And everybody, enjoy the rest of your nights or days, depending on your time zone. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.